The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks to Blinkist for supporting the Lawfare podcast. Fit more listening and reading into your life with key takeaways from the best nonfiction books. Get a free 7-day trial at Blinkist.com/lawfare.
There is the possibility of a sufficient delay. I mean, we only have 18 months until the next election. And if Trump can even put off that information becoming public, basically, which is sort of how it would be if it went to a committee, if he can even put it off, 6 months or 8 months, I think that's probably valuable to President Trump in his the run-up to 2020. I mean, I think there's also this sense, Donald Trump is very aggressive when it comes to lawsuits, and he's probably trying to maybe trying to signal to, for example, other committees or other, House Democrats who have this urge to do oversight. They're like, hey, I'm going to make this as hard for you as I possibly can.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, April 27th, 2019. The action has shifted to Congress. The Mueller report is filed, and a blizzard of subpoena fights between the White House and various congressional committees is already underway. The president has sued a committee chairman. There's a question about whether Don McGahn will testify or whether the White House will assert executive privilege over it. And looming over it all is the question of how congressional Democrats and Republicans are thinking about impeachment. We thought it was a good time to focus on Congress. So my two Brookings colleagues, Molly Reynolds and Margaret Taylor, came to the Jungle Studio to chew it all over. We talked about subpoenas, we talked about lawsuits, we talked about impeachment, and we even talked about the much-forgotten inherent contempt power of the Congress. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 412, Congress, Congress, and More Congress, with Margaret Taylor and Molly Reynolds. All right, guys, we've gone from the completely orderly process of a criminal investigator who does not leak and who does everything in formal statements in legal documents to the chaotic, unruly mess that is the Congress of the United States. Molly is smiling now because with affection.
The chaotic, unruly mess is what gets Margaret and I out of bed in the morning. It's true.
So I don't quite know where to start here. So let's start with the president's statement that he is planning to defy all subpoenas. Margaret, you have been writing for some time about the resistance to document production in a range of areas, including most particularly the security clearance investigations. That really expanded over the last week and a half. So as a preliminary matter, give us a kind of overview of where things stand.
So it's been very, very interesting to see this evolve. Earlier in the Congress, in sort of the January, February, March timeframe, we got these sort of notes about what types of arguments the White House would be making to, resist certain demands for documents. And we saw that in connection with the House Oversight and Reform Committee's request for the documents and testimony related to security clearances. And the argument that they were making there was that there's really no, valid purpose that the Congress has in looking into these matters. Now, what we've seen over the past week is that argument being expanded to essentially everything. And as you said, Ben, the president said out loud this week, and I quote, "We're fighting all the subpoenas. I say it's enough," unquote. Now, this, as far as I can see from the history, this is pretty unprecedented. You know, typically what has happened in the post-Watergate era is that presidents will receive requests for information or subpoenas even. They might supply some of the documents. They might authorize certain people to testify, but not others. And this sort of negotiation goes on between the two branches of government. But here what we're seeing is really kind of a full stonewalling and everything. And that's very unusual. And Elijah Cummings, who's the chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, sort of in response to this said, and I quote here too, "This is a massive, unprecedented, and growing pattern of obstruction. Both President Trump and Attorney General Barr are now openly ordering federal employees to ignore congressional subpoenas and simply not show up without any assertion of a valid legal privilege." So that's where we are. It's really kind of a stonewall situation. We're seeing it in a number of different settings.
All right. I want to understand this because on the one hand, it's a, as you say, a stonewall situation. On the other hand, it maximizes the legal vulnerability to a relatively quick court order saying, you can't do that. So if you are Nancy Pelosi or the committee that Nancy Pelosi recently hired a, truly first-rate appellate lawyer to handle these matters for the House, Doug Letter, did the president just give the Democrats a gold mine, which is the ability to, walk into court in enforcing any one of these subpoenas and say, you don't even need to listen to the legal argument that's being made before you. This is being resisted pursuant to a presidential directive to not comply with any subpoenas. Right? Why doesn't this have exactly the opposite effect that it's meant to? It just signals to courts there is not a good faith process of engagement with the congressional committees going on here.
So I think it probably does have that effect. I don't think that President Trump has that in mind or cares particularly too much about that, about what the preserving legal arguments when the House presumably will bring this into a civil suit. So I think it is going to pose a bit of a problem for government lawyers who are trying to argue the president's case here. But there is, this just other question of how long do legal proceedings take? And they just typically take a long time. So that's sort of the other question, aside from the merits of what a court might decide on this question of, which branch should have the prerogative, is just sort of running through the time of how long it takes typically to get through these court cases. That's a real thing here. And I think President Trump probably has a good sense for that because he's filed lots of lawsuits over the course of his career for the purpose of delay.
Yeah, and certainly if we look at Congress's recent experience with trying to use the courts to compel civil enforcement with subpoenas that have not been complied with, we see most notably the case from the mid-2000s involving the U.S. Attorney's firing scandal under the Bush administration, where the House went to court to try to compel testimony and documents from White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton and from Harriet Myers. That took several years of court battles to resolve itself. The same is true of a case litigated during the Obama administration involving then Attorney General Eric Holder and the Fast and the Furious operation. And so one of the, to a point Margaret made earlier about kind of the power of the congressional subpoena is that historically it really has been something that's been useful as a threat and to kind of compel some sort of accommodation between the executive branch and Congress, even if Congress isn't getting everything it wants. That's been the way the tool has been kind of most useful to Congress. But in situations where, the executive branch just really digs in and Congress is forced to go to the courts, it can be powerful, but it is not speedy.
Okay. In both the Fast and Furious case and the U.S. attorney's case. There was – the litigation filed a protracted period of negotiations between the White House and Congress. And it seems to me that once the president announces, we're not complying, there is no going to be a negotiation, the case ends up getting postured very differently. And so I'm thinking about, for example, the testimony of Don McGahn, which, you know, one of the committees has demanded, the Judiciary Committee has demanded and subpoenaed, and the White House has asserted that it will, you know, try to block the testimony citing executive privilege. It'll try to block compliance with the subpoena citing executive privilege, notwithstanding the fact that it has waived executive privilege. And I can't imagine a valid basis for this, despite having confidently predicted that the White House would do it. And so I do think that presents in court in a very different way if the House were to file a motion to compel, than a resistance to a subpoena after a long negotiated back and forth in which the White House actually presented a lot of material and sort of drew the line at certain points. I mean, am I being overly optimistic here, Margaret?
You mean optimistic in terms of what will actually happen?
And with the speed at which it
right.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this. If I'm a district judge and this shows up and the in the presence of a White House formal statement by the president that we're not complying with any subpoenas, the White House has asserted frivolously in the face of a waiver an executive privilege claim over the testimony of a White House counsel having not objected to the release of 200 pages of accounts of his prior interviews with the special counsel, I having waived executive privilege in that context, I can't see how a district court doesn't look at that and say, you're joking, right? And make very quick work of it.
I mean, I tend to agree, and we'll at least know sort of in some form what the next steps are because the House Judiciary Committee has demanded the documents from McGahn by May 7th and demanded his testimony before the committee by May 21st. So at that point, we'll sort of know what the next steps are. But I think, you know, even if a district court makes that finding, my sense is that the White House will appeal. And, you know, the president has said on in various of these contexts, like, I'm going to go all the way to the Supreme Court on this, or I'm going to involve the Supreme Court. And there is just a lot of time that it takes to get through that. So, you know, it will depend on how the White House sort of responds to, for example, a negative decision by a district court.
And I think one other thing that's important to keep in mind, and I think we're going to talk a little bit about this, is that perhaps also different from the Holder episode and the Bolton-Myers episode is that this conversation about the McGahn subpoena is happening in the context of many other subpoenas and lots of other confrontation. So the number of fronts on which this war is being fought are several. And so as maybe this McGahn subpoena fight is playing out in the courts, there are other ones that are happening at the same time. And so as something takes a long time, the existence of other moving parts means that it's hard to know, you know, what happens between now and whenever this particular dispute gets resolved because it's happening at the same time as a number of other ones.
All right. So one example of the White House opening a new front in this is a suit that the president and the Trump Organization filed against Elijah Cummings early this week. This document reads to me like the single most unprofessional piece of legal work product to be filed anywhere representing a president that I know of. It reads like a, you know, a completely crazy sort of fever dream of a first-year law student or something. On the other hand, it also reflects this series of arguments that they have been making in other fora that there is no valid legislative interest in these oversight matters at all, which is a common thread between the tax return stuff, this suit, and, you know, other stuff where they're resisting. So, Margaret, walk us through what the White House's argument is here and why they think they can use it to essentially stop not just individual subpoenas, but that it's a sort of plausible blanket argument to not comply in general.
So just to go back to the accounting firm case, that case was actually made, the complaint was filed in Trump's personal capacity. So it's actually not in his presidential capacity. And so just to take our listeners back a little bit in history to understand the context here, back in February, Michael Cohen testified before the Judiciary Committee, and he basically said that he participated in these instances or had awareness of instances where Trump and his companies essentially would submit information to Mazars, his accounting firm, for the purpose of having that accounting firm prepare financial documents. And he knew of instances where they sort of changed the information about, for example, the value of assets, depending on what purpose the financial documents were going to be put, whether it was for tax reasons or for, you know, a loan, you know, collateral on a loan. So there's this question about whether Donald Trump, you know, prior to when he was president, was doing these sorts of activities. And so the chairman of House Oversight and Reform, Elijah Cummings, first asked in a letter, but then subpoenaed this accounting firm, Mazars, for basically financial documents of Trump's and his companies from 2009 to the present. So that was sort of the precipitating event. That was when there was this sort of unprecedented move of Trump in his personal capacity suing Chairman Cummings and also Mazars, the accounting firm, to try to prevent Mazars from turning over those documents. And that's the sort of complaint that you were talking about, Ben, that reads, I agree with you, more kind of like a political document almost than a legal document, because there doesn't seem to be much merit to the document, which begs the question of, is this merely a delay exercise? And, you know, I agree with you, like the main sort of contention there is that, you know, there's just no valid legislative purpose that the committee could be pursuing in requesting these documents from Mazars. But Cummings actually points out the purpose of the committee's investigation. He wrote a letter to the committee members soliciting their input, and he specifies that the point of this investigation is to determine whether Trump has undisclosed conflicts of interest that may impair his ability to make impartial policy decisions, to assess whether he's complying with the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, where Congress does have a role, and to review whether he has accurately reported his finances to the Office of Government Ethics and other federal entities. And those are all very valid reasons for a congressional committee like the House Oversight and Reform Committee to request those documents. So that's why I say I don't see really any way that Trump could prevail on the merits here.
So in your judgment, what is the strategic purpose of a lawsuit like this? It's not a subpoena directed at the White House. It doesn't, unless a court finds it has some merit, which I agree with you is somewhere between most improbable and impossible. Unless that happens, it won't impair the accounting firm's ability or willingness to comply with the subpoena. The accounting firm is not a party to the litigation.
The accounting firm asked for the subpoena from the committee in order to comply with a request the committee had made of it to turn over the information.
Exactly. Right. And so it doesn't obviously produce even delay. So what's the point? Is it just chest thumping?
I do think there is the possibility of a sufficient delay. I mean, we only have 18 months until the next election, and if Trump can even put off that information becoming public, basically, which is sort of how it would be if it went to a committee, if he can even put it off, you know, 6 months or 8 months, I think that's probably valuable to President Trump in his sort of run up to 2020. I mean, I think there's also this sense, you know, Donald Trump is very aggressive when it comes to lawsuits, and he's probably trying to maybe trying to signal to, for example, other committees or other, you know, House Democrats who have this urge to do oversight. They're like, hey, I'm going to make this as hard for you as I possibly can, and you're going to be defending lawsuits, and I'm going to appeal them to the hilt. So, you know, I think he's probably trying. He really doesn't want that information out. That's the first thing it says to me. And the second thing is, you know, he's communicating to people who might be involved that there are going to be high costs to trying to get this type of information.
Yeah, I think that this your point, Margaret, about kind of the political symbolism of doing a full frontal assault on Congress's oversight power is really important. I think that the President Trump and the folks in the White House likely kind of see their goal in this, or one of their goals in this assault, is just to prove to their political base that, you know, they're going to do everything they possibly can to stand up against the Democrats on the Hill who are, you know, being unfair. And I think this gets, again, to a way in which our current environment is different than previous episodes of even very contentious oversight conflict between Congress and the executive branch. And that historically, you know, the executive branch, the White House, has seen potential political costs to not complying or sort of taking a hardline no compliance stance. And that's why historically we've seen subpoenas be valuable in compelling negotiations. And Ben talked earlier about how in the Myers and Bolton case and in the Holder case, there were protracted negotiations between Congress and the White House. And everyone was trying to reach politically and legally optimal for your respective side argument. But the politics here are just a little, I think, are different. And so that there's this value that the Trump administration sees in just being as aggressive as possible, and that's the politically optimal approach.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this, he's sort of busting through norms here, right? We've seen this president do that in a number of ways. He's definitely busting through norms here. And I think the question for the Congress, in particular House Democrats, will be, you know, how do you respond to that? Do you, you know, bust through your own norms? So, for example, as we've sort of talked about before, there's several different ways to compel a person to appear before a committee, civil enforcement actions, which we've talked about, and, you know, the potential for the executive branch to bring a, you know, a criminal misdemeanor or sort of suit against someone, which isn't going to happen. But there is this third option, which is this inherent contempt power, which hasn't been used for years and years. It, essentially, what it means is, you know, the Capitol Police would be deployed to go and get someone and bring them to Capitol Hill. And this hasn't been used in just decades and decades and decades. But, you know, the question for the Congress is, well, what are we going to do? Trump's busting through these norms. Are we going to bust through our norms of not using that type of process? And I would just note that Jerry Connolly, who's a Democrat from Virginia, actually mentioned this recently, you know, sort of just mentioning that there is this inherent contempt power for the Capitol Police to go out and bring someone before the House. So, you know, these are sort of interesting times we're living in.
Yeah. And the word that always gets thrown around in the discussion of why Congress abandoned its use of the inherent contempt power in the early 20th century is that arresting people and putting them in the Capitol jail was, quote unquote, unseemly. And so I think to your point about the times we're living in, is it more unseemly than anything else we're observing?
Well, so the Congress has one other power that's relevant to this, Margaret, as you pointed out in your piece yesterday, and that is the power of impeachment. And in the Nixon impeachment articles, as you point out, there is actually an article that deals, or a section that deals specifically with refusal to provide material to Congress. And so talk a little bit about how bad a situation would have to get before the stiffing of Congress might be thought about as a sort of independent basis for impeachment.
So, you know, traditionally there is this conflict between the executive and legislative branches over documents and compliance with subpoenas, et cetera. So we do have that as a norm. I don't think we get necessarily to the articles of impeachment right away. I think the approach that Trump and the White House are taking of this total stiff arming approach gets us further along that road. I think if and when we do see courts, so for example, district courts making rulings and saying, no, you, the president or the White House, you must comply. And if we then see continued resistance to those sorts of directives, you know, meritless appeals, and just sort of a continued blanket refusal, even when, for example, a court has weighed in, then I think we're getting more into that type of territory. And also if we see maybe if volume, it may also be a factor too. You know, if we've got just tons of subpoenas out there and tons of requests for documents and not one document is provided and not one witness is provided, I mean, that's just, that's a full frontal challenge to the Article One branch of our Constitution. And I just don't see it being healthy for our democracy and for the Constitution for Congress not to really make its views known about the unacceptability of that. And that may lead to an impeachment type, you know, act.
The Lawfare podcast has a sponsor. It's Blinkist. Since the Mueller report was released, you probably have understandably spent a lot of time digesting the report, checking social media for the latest analysis, I hope reading my diarist on the subject. And in the meantime, you've been missing the chance to sit down and read something just because you wanted to learn more. You know, books. The Blinkist app helps solve this problem. Blinkist is the only app that gives you the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books so that you can absorb those ideas in text or audio format in manageable 15-minute segments. If you're a busy person who wants to understand the main points of books quickly and without having to read the whole thing, then you should join Blinkist's 8 million users. Those 8 million Blinkist users take advantage of the app's massive and ever-growing library, which includes many nonfiction topics, politics, psychology, leadership, and history. And Blinkist has got a lot of titles that listeners of the Lawfare podcast in particular will be interested in. For example, there are a lot of constitutional questions at issue in the Mueller report. And while I've read Thomas Paine's Common Sense in the past, I wanted a refresher on its central ideas. So there's the Blinkist version of the famed pamphlet. Busy Lawfare podcast listeners might also be interested in Getting Things Done by David Allen. I like Blinkist because no matter how hectic the week gets, I can learn something new by listening to a 15-minute Blinkist audiobook. I can do this commuting, walking between meetings, or while I'm at the gym. So, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for Lawfare podcast listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/lawfare to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled Blinkist.com/lawfare to start your free 7-day trial. Again, Blinkist.com/lawfare. So, Molly, we have mostly avoided talking about impeachment, except for this one extreme remedy discussion at the end just now. But I want to talk about the congressional politics of impeachment because there it seems like a complicated, iterative, multi-level game at this point. And I'm, you know, zooming way out, not evaluating whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. How do you understand the dynamics of the politics in both the Republican caucus and the Democratic caucus? I think the Republican caucus is simpler, so let's take that one first.
Yeah, so before I dive into the Republicans, I want to kind of make an important point about what we mean when we say, when we talk about the politics of impeachment. And one part of that is this question of how does the public react to impeachment? What are future electoral implications of pursuing impeachment, for example? But there's a second sort of way in which I think it's important to think of the politics of impeachment. And that is kind of where you're getting, I think, with this question. And it has to do with that because it is a process that involves collective decisions made by members of Congress, it involves all of the same kinds of tensions within the Democratic Party, within the Republican Party. What does it mean for Speaker Pelosi, for the Republican leaders to manage their respective conferences? That intra-congressional politics is also really important. And so I appreciate sort of the question because I think that when people say impeachment is a political act, we tend to think about how does it play outside the chamber. But there's a lot of politics happening within the chamber. So on the Republican side of the aisle, both the House and the Senate at this point, we've not seen any real interest in going down the impeachment road. You know, we saw In the immediate aftermath of the release of the Mueller report, a number of Republicans, I'm thinking particularly of Senator Mitt Romney from Utah, come out with statements that were reacting to the report and saying, you know, there's a lot of bad behavior on display here, that sort of thing. But there's no real indication so far that Republicans are interested in really pressing forward on this. On the Democratic side of the aisle.
Wait, before you get to the Democrats, I'm interested in your sense of the reason for that. Is Republican lack of interest because they are in general not offended by the conduct described in the Mueller report? Because, I mean, certainly in some cases, like, you know, the sort of Mark Meadows, Jim Jordan faction, that is certainly the case. But the body of Republicans who are sort of quiet, is the dynamic right now that their substantive views of the matter don't differ all that much from the way Democrats read the report. They're just afraid of the base, which is very loyal to the president. Or are they actually interpreting the evidence in a fashion that is different and more generous?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not inside the heads of Republican members of Congress. If I was, I'd have a different job. But I think that there's some variation. So I think probably some of them look at both the facts on the page in the Mueller report and sort of what they see as the production of the report and kind of aren't bothered by that. But I think in other cases, they probably do find, you know, the conclusions objectionable, but think that if there's any way for them to be effective in pushing back against the White House, that sort of joining calls for impeachment aren't the way to do that. And I think this is an important point to make about kind of what's been happening in Congress more broadly, that there's so much that we don't see on the outside. And to the extent that there are Republicans who have had objections to a whole range of things that have been happening, the idea that from their perspective, the most effective way to try to affect change in what's happening is to do it in a way that we don't see.
I also would just add, I mean, I think we can't underestimate what Republicans and Democrats, too, they've been home for 2 weeks. We can't underestimate what they are actually hearing from constituents. And it will be interesting to see in the next week, once they're back, sharing with each other what they heard from their constituents, because I actually think there's probably a pretty good chance that a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats, too, what they heard from their constituents was, I want to move on. Let's just move on from this. Let's focus on other things. And that is something that members are going to listen to. And, you know, it's going to be a part of their calculation about how they move forward.
And certainly if we look, for example, at the issues that voters said were important to them as part of the 2018 midterms, the Russia investigation, kind of President Trump's misconduct, did not rank very high on that list at all. When voters are asked kind of what matters to you, what do you want to see Congress doing, they're much more likely to talk about things like healthcare and the economy. And so when we sort of start to bridge this gap between the internal congressional politics and the external politics of potentially pursuing impeachment, I think that's a really important point that Margaret brings up, is that, you know, what members are hearing from voters matters as we go forward.
All right. So talk about the Democratic caucus. The dynamics there seem to be much more complicated in the sense that there is a faction that, typified by Elizabeth Warren, who are arguing that there is an affirmative duty to impeach. There is a faction that is very skeptical of that as a political kamikaze mission. And there seem to be a lot of people who are kind of interested in using continued investigation as some kind of surrogate for an impeachment process. So how do you assess the dynamics within the Democratic caucus?
Yeah, so first of all, I think that's a pretty good summary of kind of where we are, is that there are some folks in the Democratic caucus who have, and you pointed out that Senator Warren has said this on her presidential campaign trail. One more general consequence of the fact that we're in the very early stages of the 2020 election is that, and we have, you know, 20-ish Democrats running for president, is that they can be asked about things like this on the trail, and then that puts it on everyone's agenda to get asked about, particularly when, you know, members of Congress are back in town next week. So, you know, there's that part of the party. There's a part of the party who's much more skeptical of this. And then, as you describe, there's folks in the middle who say, you know, we need to continue to use our investigative authority. Do we need to call it impeachment? Do we need to say that that's what we're building towards? Maybe not yet. And so one of the challenges for Speaker Pelosi, the other Democratic leaders in the House, including Jerry Nadler, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, is how to manage those tensions within the House Democratic Caucus. And importantly, they don't exist in isolation from other debates that are happening within the Democratic Caucus in the House about the direction of the party. And so, you know, this is obviously a very substantively important issue, but we can't think about it in isolation from the fact that there are lots of other things that the folks who tend to want to be more aggressive on impeachment might disagree with the folks who are less aggressive on impeachment going forward. And so Margaret does raise this really important point that we're having this conversation at a moment where the members of the House Democratic Caucus have not physically been in Washington since the report was released. They've been back in their districts. There was this conference call earlier this week where they kind of heard from various leaders and had a chance to talk about what the party's strategy might be going forward. But I don't want to underestimate the importance of, you know, them being in the same place when they get back into town next week. And I think we'll start to get a better sense of what their strategy is going to be going forward.
Margaret, one question that I have when I watch these sort of flurries of investigative activity, particularly out of the Judiciary Committee, is whether we should understand them as preparatory toward impeachment, a surrogate in lieu of impeachment, or maybe one and maybe the other. And in the minds of Jerry Nadler, it is, and his staff, it is genuinely unclear, and they're actually having a sort of an undirected investigative process that leads wherever it leads. Do you have a sense of whether the strategic goal on the part of Democrats here is to use investigation instead of impeachment, or whether it's a genuinely open investigative process that will kind of lead to impeachment if that's where it leads? Or is it all, as Trump describes, you know, a kabuki, you know, show trial? I don't mean that that sounds more negative than I mean it, but establishing the predicate in order then to impeach.
So my sense of the situation is that the House Democrats are genuinely trying to keep their options open at this point. They'd had in their minds that they were going to pursue these investigations even before the Mueller report came out. I think the Mueller report adds more color and more direction to a number of the investigations that were already open. So I think for now, I don't think they're quite clear on exactly where they are headed with this. What it may end up looking like is sort of, you know, these investigations, which look very much like impeachment proceedings, but they're not called that. And so what we might be seeing over time is that Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, I think genuinely does feel like this needs to be dealt with in a serious way in committee. There's not consensus on the word impeachment and pursuing impeachment proceedings, but what I can do is go ahead and do things that sort of very much look like that. Thereby leaving the caucus's options open for a decision at a later time. That's my sense of where they are at this point. But again, you know, once they're back, they're in the same room, a lot of things can happen. A lot of things can happen in a room when they're all together. So we'll just have to see.
So I'm going to make an important process point. Hopefully other people think it's important. I think all process points are important. That has to do with kind of the change over time in the powers afforded to congressional committees and what the Judiciary Committee now has the ability to do in its investigations as a matter of course that it did not necessarily have the ability to do during earlier periods where we had impeachment proceedings against the president, so President Clinton and President Nixon. So let's take, for example, subpoena power. So congressional committees have had subpoena power for a long time, but we've seen important changes over time in basically how easy it is for a committee chair to issue a subpoena unilaterally, what he has to do to go through the committee to issue the subpoena. And so in 1998, for example, the House Judiciary Committee chair did not, as a matter of course, have unilateral subpoena power. And so one of the things that the authorizing resolution starting the impeachment investigation did is it made it easier for the Judiciary Committee in 1998 to subpoena witnesses in the conduct of its impeachment proceedings. Because of other changes in the way this process works, that is not – it's not as big of a deal now because it's the House Judiciary Committee. It's easier for them to issue subpoenas than it was in the late 90s. And so there are kind of other changes in the investigative powers of committees that mean that the Judiciary Committee can do some things now that it needed special authorization to do in earlier impeachment proceedings. And so just in terms of kind of the nuts and bolts of the process, that taking a resolution to the House floor that says we are beginning an investigation that may result in impeachment proceedings and having the full House vote on that, that as a matter of kind of investigative power, it doesn't matter as much as it used to.
No, but I want to suggest that it matters very deeply in a different way. Which is that, you know, when you're doing investigative hearings, the goal is to create a factual record. And, you know, you're examining in question, talking to witnesses, but you're not evaluating that evidence against the standards of treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, the historic record of what we do and don't impeach for. And you're not evaluating that conduct in the way that you are when you say, okay, this is the setting in which we try to decide whether to have an impeachment. I remember very clearly during the Clinton impeachment, you know, the House had these hearings where they talked about the historic standard of what an impeachable offense was, right? They talked about prior impeachments. And you don't do that in an investigative committee setting. You do that in the context of evaluating the record that exists for purposes of a particular House power that exists, right? And I do wonder if all the focus on when Democrats say investigation, not the I stands for investigation, not impeachment, what they're really saying is we don't want to evaluate.
So I think that's an important point, and I think it speaks to a broader point, which is that we, members of Congress, others in the public, need to be clearer about what we mean when we say, does impeachment matter? And so I've laid out one set of factors that have to do with process and the ability of the committee to get information. Margaret has written about the question of would it be easier for the Judiciary Committee to get access to the grand jury materials if they were doing impeachment as opposed to just an investigation. That's one argument. You've laid out a different but important argument. And I think that we all would benefit from being clearer about what when we say, like, does impeachment matter? And just calling it impeachment matter, what exactly are we talking about?
And I would just say in response, Ben, that I will be watching closely exactly the types of questions that House Democrats are asking people like Don McGahn, if Don McCann comes before the committee. Do they reference impeachment ideas or not in their questioning? Because when you're in a committee hearing and you're, you know, questioning someone, you can say whatever you want. You can talk about impeachment if you want. Members can do whatever they want. And so I will be very keenly interested. Maybe there will be a split. Maybe some on the committee who favor impeachment proceedings will talk about impeachment in the context of those investigation hearings, and people who don't won't. I mean, it will be an interesting way to see where individuals are and how they are wanting to talk about these issues.
And that alone is a sort of additionally interesting political question in how does the chairman, how do other House leaders kind of manage those impulses on the part of their members? And, you know, we have proceedings and procedures that we usually see committee hearings follow, the 5-minute rule where members get 5 minutes to answer, to ask questions. You know, we've seen some people call for a different format for coming hearings, using, say, instead of having members each have 5 minutes, using a different format. So those kinds of like very specific questions about what form does all of this take, I think, are really important.
All right. I think we are going to leave it there for now, although I think this stuff is so fast moving that we will probably have to reconvene pretty quickly. Margaret, Molly, thanks so much for joining us. And as Charlie Sykes would say, we'll do it all over again.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, particularly on a day like today when it's an all Brookings cast on the Lawfare podcast. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare podcast. You've been doing a good job with it. Our listenership is really going up, but you need to continue helping with that. So tweet the Lawfare podcast, share us on Facebook, put us on Pinterest. We don't get a lot of Pinterest attention to the Lawfare podcast. Got to fix that, people. Give us a rating on iTunes, on Stitcher, on whatever podcast distribution service you use. Go to thelawfarestore.com and buy awesome Lawfare merch. Our audio engineer is Matt Kahn. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by the long-suffering Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.